Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We are giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Sundays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m. And based upon those time slots, I'm sure you have already surmised that I am Memorex. I am not real. I am not in studio live at 7 a.m. or 7 p.m. or 1 a.m. I don't want to get up quite that early on a Sunday morning. I'd like to be home with my wife in the evening at 7 p.m. And there is no way, if I can help it, unless for some reason they put me on the overnight shift, then I'm going to be doing the program live at 1 a.m. Although I will tell you that if one of my guests was only available and I really wanted that guest, I'd be here live. I guarantee you. This is Tell Me Your Story. We are looking for new paradigms for a new world and trying to find those choices, give those choices to you and the knowledge thereof so that you can fulfill your dreams. Today is absolutely no exception. I am going to basically tell you that we've got an interesting show today. We're going to go back in time. I'm not sure how many thousands of years, but then we're going to bring it right back to the present day. We're going to be talking about a lot of neat stuff. I hope that you will stay with us because we have a guest on the line. He is the author of, and I'm going to have him correct me if I'm wrong here. It's like a series. This particular book we're talking about, it's fiction. It is Dragon Heir. Now, that's H-E-I-R, as in inheritance. Dragon Heir is the title of the book, and it deals with, well, dinosaurs, for one, deals with man, and we're going to find out that connection therein, because, at least from my recollections in human history, man and dinosaurs didn't mix too well. I want to welcome to our studios here, Glenn Paris. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks, Richard, for having me.
This is interesting. It's not something that we've touched on over the years as far as going back quite so far. but you and I had one of the most... I wish we had been recording the interview then, our conversation was so fascinating because we were literally, on the one hand, all over the board, and yet everything...
Yeah, we were doing pretty good, weren't we?
We were, and yet everything was connected. Now, I don't want, and I say this with all due respect and humor, I say this somewhat flippantly or facetiously. After our conversation, I was starting to think, this guy sounds an awful lot like DeGrasse Tyson. You know, and just because the information was just flowing out of you and the things that we were talking about. First of all, let's talk about, I love science fiction. I grew up reading it. I grew up watching it. Obviously, a big Trekkie fan, among other things. I did watch some of the B-roll types of science fiction shows like, oh, I don't know, Lost in Space. That was a little campy, but it was interesting. And I remember one science fiction book I read cover to cover, and I have a visual impairment that when I was that age, I was legally blind, so I needed a magnifying glass. And this was one of those really thick paperback books. Now, even for people with great vision, holding a thick paperback book is tough, but try doing it with one hand.
Man, that's like reading it through a keyhole, isn't it?
It really is. And the book was called The Prometheus Project. And it had to do with the U.S.-Russian conflict and this giant rocket called Prometheus and so forth.
Yes.
By the way, Prometheus, the god of fire and so forth, someone told me that that would be, if there was a Greek god to represent Tell Me Your Story, that would be it, because it was also about knowledge, the god of knowledge and the god of fire. And so anyway, I read that thing covered. I mean, I was up late at night sitting in the living room when I was living at home with my parents. I couldn't put it down. It was fantastic. And I've always enjoyed those kinds of stories. I wrote a few of my own short stories back in high school. And sometimes they would just come. They just flowed. I'm curious because this is sort of a monumental piece of work here. I mean, this could go on forever. Where do your roots in science fiction start?
Oh, my goodness. I remember the very first science fiction novel that I, well, the first novel that I ever read was Andre Norton's Time Search. And the first short story collection I ever read was Larry Niven's Flight of the Horse. When I got into high school, it's funny that you bring up Neil deGrasse Tyson. We were actually in the same high school at the same time.
No.
I was a couple of years ahead of me. So we really didn't know each other. Upperclassmen didn't mix with mere freshmen and sophomores. But you know, we both went to the Bronx High School of Science in New York City. So that's a, you know, it's a basically a school for nerds, as you might guess. and we had a big science fiction book club. You know, almost all the kids read some version of science fiction. So, you know, it was really a haven for people who like to read that kind of thing and really, you know, dig into it. You know, simple stuff didn't satisfy us. You know, we had to talk about it. You know, we had to dissect it. We had to, you know, find the flaws in it. It's like, ah, this wouldn't work because da-da-da-da-da. And, you know, we had access to the knowledge to make those kinds of arguments. So it was pretty cool. Enjoying science fiction and talking about science fiction with people who liked it, instead of being, you know, that one kid in the, you know, the corner of the bus who's reading science fiction while everybody else is talking about cool stuff.
You know,
I had an interesting high school experience in that regard.
Mm-hmm. And that was?
Oh, that was that I got a chance to hear about a lot of science fiction novel stories that, you know, mostly you couldn't hear about because you just didn't have the time to do it. But when you've got, you know, 100, 200 kids who are reading science fiction and they tell you, oh, you got to read this story. It's about such and such. You know, you get this sense that, okay, great. There's so much more out there to learn. But if you're doing it on your own, you know, even if you get a chance to peruse bookstores every weekend, you know, you don't know where to start. You can't buy enough books. But, you know, you borrow a book that somebody lent you that was really good. And, you know, they told you the gist of the story. You know, it was really cool to be in that environment. You know, it was, you know, it just encouraged reading and encouraged thinking and encouraged imagination. And I think it was priceless for me as a writer.
I find it interesting, too. One of my favorite trilogies, and actually it's more than just three parts, was the Dune series by Frank Herbert, who, by the way, I'm not mistaken, he wrote Prometheus Project. I think that was one of the reasons why it was so interesting to me.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, the thing about Herbert, you know, his first big book, Dune, of course, was revolutionary. In fact, so much so, the publishing industry didn't know what to do with it. He was rejected, I think I have this number correct, 109 times. And he was finally published by a technical manual publisher. It wasn't even a literature publisher. You know, some engineer read Dune, thought it was fantastic, and says, why isn't this published? And he actually published it through the a publishing company that published technical manuals for machines and devices and such.
I have to say that writing really good science fiction is just an incredible art. When I think about specifically the Dune trilogies, although I also read, I just finished one of the classics, Stranger in a Strange Land.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have the hard, the I don't even know what to call it because it's not a hard copy. Well, yeah, it's a hard copy, not hard cover, hard copy. And I bought that years ago, which I still have, and I tried reading it. And finally, I found it on Audible, and I listened to it several times. Actually, I had to keep rereading certain chapters, and I finally grokked it. But and I loved the story, and of course, the comparison to that and Dune is the fact that you had such a intertwining of all aspects of human existence, political, religious, social, you know, and on. And then, of course, you had space travel. The only thing about Stranger in a Strange Land that I didn't like was the ending. I thought, are you, and I'm not going to spoil it for anybody, but I'm just going to say, are you kidding me? It's kind of like when at the end of The Sopranos, are you kidding me? Really?
Sometimes endings are anticlimactic, and so much so, either you get an ending that makes no sense, and the Dune series had an ending like that. I really didn't like the ending to the Dune series.
Yeah.
It seemed almost silly to me, but it was after Frank Herbert had passed away.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's hard for somebody else to catch his vision.
Exactly.
You know, I think since then, Kevin Anderson and Brian Herbert did a pretty good job, you know, sort of picking up the baton and running with it after they got their legs under them. But it's hard to pick up somebody else's vision. But sometimes fiction just kind of stops at the end of the story or at the end of the book instead of finishing. You know, and I think that's what you're talking about.
Yeah. Oh, exactly. And like I said, I've written one or two short science fiction stories, and I used to I do a little drawing, and I actually used to do these. It wasn't actually a flip book, but it was different. I guess you'd call them panels of you know, the Lost in Space series, because the Jupiter 2 was so easy to draw.
Oh yeah,
because it was
sure.
a flying saucer.
Right.
But the thing that I found so fascinating about both Dune as well as Stranger in a Strange Land and any of the other science fiction books that writers who incorporate all of these different elements and to come up with the intricacies of doctrine and dogma, that the injection of religion or spirituality or metaphysics, however you want to put it, to me, that is the most. It's got to be one of the most difficult pieces to intertwine in there, because you have to come
it
up
is,
with.
It is, but you know the other thing about that, Richard.
Yeah.
It's also the most human.
Yeah. Oh, you know, absolutely.
If you want to try to separate, you know, for example, Orson Scott Card's stories where the enemy is sort of this hive mentality. You know, it's hard to relate to them because there's not a sense of moral center there. You know, but you learn by the end of the book that there actually is. You start off thinking that there's sort of this nebulous group of ruthless insects. And you find out that, you know, they really do have feelings. They really care about each other. They have, you know, some spirituality to them. And, you know, he followed that, you know, Ender's Game with Speaker to the Dead. You know, it's really interesting when you sort of insert that what we think of as humanity into the other. Because that's how we, you know, separate ourselves from the other. The other doesn't speak our language. The other doesn't have the same emotions or feelings that we have. The other doesn't have the same sense of right and wrong, of truth and honor. But when you realize that the other has just sort of a different take on those same values that you have, you know, that's where communication begins. And, you know, that's what I built into Dragon's Air. You know, I start off Dragon's Air strictly from the perspective of these people. And I emphasize people as opposed to monsters or creatures. These people who evolved alongside the dinosaurs, the way we evolved alongside lions and tigers and bears. You know, we don't think of ourselves as, you know, like those animals. We're different from the animals, but we have the same origins. These people have the same origins as some of the dinosaurs that we might see in Jurassic Park, but they're very, very clearly people with political agendas, spirituality, ethos, emotions. I mean, Dragon's Air is actually a love story. The archaeologist who tells the story wouldn't even have been on the trip had not her love interest, Tur, been commanded to take this expedition back to Earth to solve this very treacherous problem that they found themselves facing. And as she gets there, she tries to do everything that she can to help him. That's how she gets into trouble. But, you know, again, it takes into account this what we might call alien race with far too many similarities to us. It mirrors us in all kinds of dark ways. You know, I'm a physician by training, and I can't help but include, you know, some healthcare issues in this. And, you know, we make healthcare so difficult. And yet we know that if we were to take care of everybody and offer health care, the price would come down, the country would be healthier, we'd spend less money on it. But, you know, it becomes a commodity in some cases, it gets rationed in other cases, and hence we spend much more on it than we should. In Dragon's Air, they really don't do health care. They have the knowledge, but if you are injured or wounded or sick, nature takes its course. You're allowed water. They don't bring you food. Why waste food on the weak?
Mm-hmm.
So what they've done is they've created this sort of breeding program where only the strong survive. Sounds very simplistic, but when you take that to a societal level, you know, you basically eliminate most diseases because those who survive have certain immunity or resistance to these diseases. And you also begin to monitor for any kind of epidemic trends so that they don't happen.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, as far as colds and hypertension and diabetes and coronary disease and cancers, they just don't get those things. You know, like sharks don't get cancer. You know, if a shark stops swimming, a shark dies. A shark has always got to be swimming, always got to be eating. So weakness is death to a shark.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's interesting, too, because a lot of people will, for example, they will quote Darwin and they will say, the basic law of nature is, you know, survival of the fittest, except for one problem. That's not the quote. It's the survival of the strongest. That was the word that was used. And there's a difference between the fittest and the strongest. Big difference, in my opinion. Yeah. Maybe it's semantics. But it's interesting, too, and I want to dive more into this as well. But it's also interesting, too, how when I take a look at our current day, time and things that are happening in the world today.
It is very interesting. And I wrote this book, you know, before the present situation. I mean, even before Obama was elected.
Yeah.
I wrote this book. And it's interesting, you know, the way the pendulum swings,
mm-hmm.
you know, from one extreme to the other, you know, and in the modern era, you know, some of these very same arguments take place in the second chapter in the book.
Yeah. Well, the thing I was going to bring up was that during the, for example, going back 40 years, even during Iran-Contra, I was hearing people saying, and folks, if you don't know what that is, Google it.
We're showing our age, Richard.
I know. But the thing that struck me was comments that were made that, oh my, this is so bizarre. Hollywood couldn't even written a script like this. Well, in our day and time now, you're looking at the same thing, you know. But the one thing that I find so fascinating about what's happening, and on a political level, not to get political, is how maybe they do understand, but the public doesn't seem to get it because you have such unbelievable polarization. And that is that the reason why certain things are happening today is because certain things happened yesterday. And the two factions, which I don't believe they're really two, they're basically the same, but they're playing this little game with us. But needless to say, it's tit for tat. That's what's going on. You did this to us back then, so we're doing this to you now, which means that in the future, they're going to do to you what you did to them, that they did to you,
escalates.
And the bottom line is it's kind of like that childhood thing where a parent walks into the room, what happened here? What are you doing? What's going on? Well, he started it. And it's like, okay, well, who's going to finish it? Who's going to stop this nonsense, this bickering, this infighting that is not serving the people it's supposed to serve? And that's you and me. That's going down another road in that regard.
But, you know, there's a German philosophy.
Yes.
And I sort of use this in my own child rearing. There's a German philosophy. When you don't know what kid did it, you put them both in a bag, you tie it up, you hit them with a hammer, and you got the right one.
Well,
it's not literal.
No,
but,
no, no. Let's make sure that clear.
Philosophically.
Exactly.
You know,
that's like putting two cats in a bag. Yeah.
You make them solve their own problem.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there is the other one. There is a Solomon's solution: cut the kids in half, cut the kid in half, or something along those lines.
Yeah, who loves the kid most? Right.
Exactly. This, to me, again, is fascinating. But we also want to talk about some of the history now. Now it's interesting, we're kind of dive in here to the issue of dinosaurs. And by the way, my wife and I love dragons. I mean, just the concept, the mythology surrounding them. Love watching.
There's a very interesting, it's almost a cult of this love of dragons, this mythical creature that we've never seen before. You know, it's not as beautiful as the unicorn, but far, far more wide-ranging and popular.
Yeah.
Isn't it interesting that almost every culture knows the dragon in one form or another?
Oh, yeah,
and,
yeah.
And they verge on, they don't quite worship it, but they verge on that. Isn't it fascinating?
Yeah. Well, I want to make sure that if I ever have a dragon, he does talk, and he does sound like Sean Connery. Because I think Sean's voice has always been the best voice for a dragon.
Wasn't it, though?
Oh, loved it. But it's interesting, the aspect of the mythology therein, but also in terms of the realities of, for example, dinosaurs, which, you know, you could say, well, it's kind of akin to a dinosaur. I don't know. You know, you had your flying... I'm not even sure what
right?
You had your flying dinosaurs. Okay, I wasn't sure what the generic term would be in that regard.
Yeah, well, pterosaurs, pterodactyls, pterosaurs.
But yeah. I remember as I was growing up and going to school and getting educated, that I was taught that that's where we got our petroleum from. And I thought, wait a minute, we've been sucking oil out of the ground since before the turn of the century, since what, the 1850s or so?
Right. There's a short story that I wrote called Spiral
that
talks a little bit about this, and this is after Dragon's Air.
Mm-hmm.
But suppose you have a civilization, you know, maybe it's as advanced as ours, maybe more advanced, and it falls, it crumbles. Mm-hmm. And we talked a little bit in our last conversation, Richard, about Troy. You know, Homer's Troy from the Trojan Wars and the Odyssey.
Oh, yeah.
Troy was not one city, but it was nine cities. All right, suppose you had a civilization that fell 65 million years ago. It has something to do with the fragment collision with the asteroid, but suppose that civilization fell. Suppose that it was as complicated as our megalopolis type cities are, you know, that sprawling Los Angeles megalopolis and the New York City tri-state megalopolis. Suppose you have all of that biomass, you know, whether it's pets or food or waste products, and it sits and it rots for 65 million years. The supernatant is rich in hydrocarbons, right?
Okay.
If you sip that out, if you dig in and you get to the top of that cesspool of waste, and you sip some of that out, like through an oil rig, all right? Mm-hmm. You can burn that stuff, and that's fuel. But what's the bottom of that? You never see it. We've never gotten to the bottom of a well. Mm-hmm. We just drain it until we can't drain any more fluid from it, and then we go on to another place.
Right.
There are certain places that oil is very rich. There's Pennsylvania, there's Oklahoma, there's Texas, there's Alaska, there's the coast of Louisiana. And there are many other places. There's Venezuela, Nigeria, Siberia. There are many places where there are these huge reserves of fossil fuels. Saudi Arabia, the biggest one. So suppose that we're sitting on top of these big, big ancient cities that have died millions and millions and millions of years ago, and we had no clue that the real treasure is not the oil that rests on top of them, but the technology that's buried there. things that we can't even imagine.
And we're
just
talking,
suppose.
Yeah, and we're talking now, and we're taking into consideration the fact, the potential reality that man has cycled through these, it's been said, 5,000-6,000-year cycles, has wiped itself out because of its own technological advancements, if you will, that went amok or went awry or what have you. And so that's what's buried down there. Now, what's interesting, though, from my perspective is that with the volume of this liquid that we have siphoned out of the ground, even though we only go so deep because once we get to the bottom of where the straw is, we stop and we go find another source.
Right.
But it seems to me that we've pulled so much out of the ground in 150 some odd, I think it's about 150, maybe something like
about
that.
About 120 years.
120 years. That it's like, wait a minute, there were that many dinosaurs on the planet that would provide that much of this black
keep in mind,
gold?
It's not just the dinosaur carcasses.
Okay.
We're talking about, suppose that the population of Earth 65 million years ago, these people, these men, these women, these people,
right?
Not only had the people with a population of, say, 10 billion.
Okay.
Think about that number, 10 billion.
Gotcha.
They also had livestock. They had farms. They had material and technology, perhaps some of it organic in nature. You have overgrowth of vegetation that gets into this. All right, so it's not just the biomass of the people that we're talking about.
Okay.
It's the biomass of that entire biosphere that's buried.
Well, a friend of mine shared something with me along these lines that I was speculating about, and I hadn't even thought about that potential. And, of course, I'm thinking, well, if they've got farms, they must be mighty small if you've got 10 billion people on the planet. But he was saying...
Think of how little surface area we actually use.
Well, that's
whether
true.
Whether the terrain is inhospitable or it just hasn't been developed. But think about it. Even in this country, how much of the center of the country is just wide open? Think about the populations of the Dakotas, of Nebraska, of Wyoming, Idaho, Utah. I mean, you know, so much of that space is not even it's not even occupied. It's not used.
Yeah. Well, he was sharing with me his theory, and supposedly he had some science to back it up. He said that, no, that's not where the oil comes from. It's not from the decaying remnants of dinosaurs, and you know, we'll throw in people and the livestock and so forth. He says, there are these microbes that exist below the Earth, you know, below the Earth in these open spaces.
That's part of it, too. But when the microbes... devour or consume calories. Mm-hmm. You know, they've got to process them, and then there's waste.
That's what he was saying. That's what it is.
Right.
Yeah, and that's why there is conceivably an endless supply because they continue to consume and excrete. You know.
Sure.
Similar to what we do.
They consume all the available nutrients.
Yeah.
And that may take thousands and thousands of years.
Yeah.
Well, that builds up almost a sea of this waste material that we can actually burn.
Yeah. It's very interesting.
And the gas that it also gives off. Remember, it's not all liquid.
Yeah.
There's what we call natural gas, methane gas, which is the end product of breakdown of complex hydrocarbons.
Yeah.
Methane is a very simple one carbon molecule.
It's just very interesting to see where things come from. There's no question, but at the same time, you know, we sit here we are, 21st century. We've got some major ecological problems that I don't know. Some folks are addressing on a private level, but when it comes to on a public level, in some countries, the U.S. is one of them. We're not doing enough on a governmental level to solve some of these problems. And I pull people out of the whole climate change, global warming argument. I said, forget that. Just set that aside. Don't you think it would be a good idea to clean up our home, Forget global warming and whether or not man has had anything to do with the rise in temperatures. Don't you think it would just be a good idea to clean up the oceans and clean up the land and stop putting more pollutants in the air through our exhaust of our vehicles and our factories? Wouldn't that, to me, that's a heck of a lot stronger argument than, well, because of global warming and because of the fact that man is causing the temperatures to rise 1 degree every year and on and on and on and on. Because there are too many people who are saying it's fake science, it's this, it's that, it's the other. And I just, I get so tired of hearing that phrase. And then there are those who say, well, it doesn't matter. So then I throw this out. I throw this out to you, Glenn. If it doesn't matter, then I'm coming over to your house with my garbage. I'm dumping it in your living room because it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. I'm also going to defecate and urinate in the corner of your living room, too, because it doesn't matter. I have no effect on your environment. I'm just a man.
George Carlin said it probably best. Mm-hmm. You know, he talked about, you know, your crap and my stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and it was a great bit, but, you know, he says, why is everybody else's crap replacing my stuff? And he hit it. He hit it so beautifully. It was almost poetic. Your stuff doesn't matter to me. Your stuff is crap. Mm-hmm. My stuff is important.
That's right.
And when everybody thinks like that, you know, you have war because everybody is crapping in someone else's living room, as you say. And at the same time, they're disrespecting my stuff. Mm-hmm. And everybody has my stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I like Stephen Wright's comment along those same lines. He says, if you had everything in the world, where would you put it? You know?
Yeah. You wonder about people who accumulate so much they couldn't possibly spend it or consume it in a lifetime or even 10 lifetimes. Yeah. Why do they keep consuming? Why do they keep accumulating?
By the way, you touched on something that I have finally come to an interesting conclusion about. I've watched a lot of the hoarding programs, all right, where people pile stuff up in their homes and they might have a little narrow path that's going through the house, right?
Right.
Also
right.
risking avalanche and so forth.
Right, sure.
Well, guess what? There's another form of hoarder that we really have not addressed in any of these programs. I'm sure psychologists and psychiatrists have, and that is the 1%. The 1% on this planet who hold the trillions and trillions of dollars, that's how is that not hoarding?
That is. It absolutely is.
Yeah.
When you have enough for yourself. You have enough for your children. You have enough for their progeny infinitum.
Yeah.
Why prevent someone else from sharing? Why not share?
Yeah. Tell me about Glenn Paris. Where do you hail from, I'll say philosophically, religiously, spiritually?
Well, I was raised Episcopalian. I have floated around from Methodist to Church of Christ. I am a Christian, but at the same time, I'm a man of science. So I look at science, I look at evolution, I look at biblical writings. And I think where I came to settle is that I recognized that if I can put it in religious terms, and, you know, I get both sides pissed off at me, you know, when I do this, but you got to bring both sides to the middle eventually anyway.
Right.
Science is simply catching the hand of God in motion. And it's just that simple. All right. It's magic if you don't see him do it. Okay.
Yeah.
It's a miracle if you don't see him do it. But if you watch what's happening, you understand it. Does that make it any less miraculous? No.
Yeah. My perspective on miracles is miracles are only miracles because we don't understand the process. If we understood the process, it wouldn't be a miracle. And that's what I've often said in regards to Jesus and all of the miracles that you read about in the four Gospels. Right. Is to him, it was no big deal because that's just what he did because that's who he was. But to everybody else around him, and I also love the phrase that he uttered after being questioned by his disciples, "Wow, that was pretty cool, man. Can we do that?" And his reply was, "This? Sure. But you guys are going to do greater stuff." And what I have, and I kind of want to dive into this from your perspective. My perspective of the greater stuff isn't turning water into wine or raising the dead, et cetera, et cetera. It's transforming ourselves into, I don't know, to a greater version of who we used to be, into something greater than what we used to be, you know?
Almost divinity, raising ourselves to divinity.
Exactly.
And that's another thing that I touch on in Dragon's Air, that they're part of their judgment of us, because they do sit in the very second chapter, even in the first chapter, they sit in judgment of us. All right. So, and they don't want us. And that's the interesting thing. They don't want us as part of their group. They don't want us. So they will grant that we've developed advanced language. They will grant that we have technology that is clearly above savagery. They will grant that we have political structures that mirror their own political structures. They grant that we have begun to creep into space. They grant all these things, and that we have evolved on Earth. But they are trying so, so hard to find a way of denying the fact that we are children of the Earth as they were, and that we have a right to be shepherded into a greater society. And the way they do it is they have intelligence, they have technology, but they are not enlightened like we are. Ah. And as they are not enlightened and not self-aware and not aware of the cosmos in general as we are, they don't have these spiritual spheres of influence where they can actually change their environments through will alone. Because we don't have that, we are not worthy to join their society. As diverse as it is, they have 400 different species, intelligent species, some in opposition to each other, some symbiotic with each other, but they get along and they accept one another.
Yeah. You know,
we're a bridge too far. Mammals are a bridge too far for them.
Ah, there's a great poem.
And they resent the fact that we look like them.
I can appreciate that. Hey, there was a poem that was written by the author Tiberius. That I read some years ago, and I have it.
You are so well read, Richard. I'm just so impressed with the breadth of literature that you're familiar with. It's just amazing.
Well, I'm 58. I have not read Ulysses, and I'm working on it.
that's a tough nut to crack, I can tell you.
I'm going to work on it because I love Ireland. I want to live there the rest of my life if I can just get there one more time with a one-way ticket. The poem by Tiberius, basically, and I'm going to paraphrase it. Basically, the gods, they're noticing that man is starting to question his origins and wanting to be, again, raise themselves up to the divine. They're becoming enlightened, and they're wanting more. The gods are a little concerned about this because, you know, this could, so to speak, put them out of work.
That's our turf.
So
right.
they have this little ecumenical conclave, and they say, "Hey, we know what the secret is, and we got to hide the secret, because if we don't, they're gonna take over our job, so to speak." So they start debating. Okay, we'll hide it at the on the highest mountain. No, they'll find a way to climb to the top. We'll put it at the depths of the sea, you know. They'll never go there. Oh yeah, they'll find a way to get down there. We'll put it here. We'll put it there. We'll put it over there. We'll put it under this. We'll put it on top of that, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, there was always the no, because they'll find a way. Finally, one god speaks up and says, "I know where we'll hide it. We'll hide it in man's heart. He'll never look there."
I love it. Yes.
And it's a fascinating look at the reality that is today, that we, and this is a focus of our radio program, Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, and looking for those new ways of living, that until we find those new ways of living within ourselves, you can forget about the outside world. It doesn't matter, because This is one of the things Jacques Fresco, who is a visionary futurist who has since passed, talked about, and was sharing with me his concepts of the future, future civilization structure, infrastructure, and social, religious, etc. And I was so excited, and I said, oh my God, this is great. I would love to have this now. What, do you think this will happen in our lifetimes? And I was talking about he and he was 94 at the time. He says, it's not going to happen in my lifetime, he says. But he says, it's probably not going to happen in yours. Because the consciousness of man is not even close to the level it needs to be in order for some of the things to happen. And Einstein said it best, you cannot solve the problems that we or challenges that we face with the same intellect, the same consciousness, if you will, that created it. You have to rise above.
Right. That's the whole point of enlightenment.
Yeah.
Enlightenment is beyond just intellect. Mm-hmm. There is a consciousness, there's a moral position, a moral compass that you have to be able to find it in your heart not to do things that you're perfectly capable of doing or maybe even want to do.
Yeah.
And in I think that one of the last chapters in as we get to the climax and then the denouement of the book, there's a moment where any human being would say, okay, he's going to make this decision and we're really screwed here, because, you know, any of us would do exactly what we think that he's going to do. And then he doesn't do it. And then this character, you know, cites why he doesn't do it. And it's so mature.
Yeah.
That you say, okay, maybe we're not ready. You know, it's the whole book is really taken from the perspective of somebody, or I say somebody, from a civilization, of a people, a perspective that is similar to what we've had over many other societies, you know, in Western culture for the last several hundred years. And what if we're on the other side of that coin?
Interesting. Very interesting. We're talking with Glenn Paris, and by the way, folks, I'm fascinated by the way you spell your name, because Glenn has two N's and Paris has two R's.
Well, you know, I'm double trouble.
Very good. And if I was really heavy into numerology, I'd know exactly where the N and the R's fall, and we could play with that as well. We're going to continue our conversation with Glenn Paris. We're talking about, of course, Dragon's Heir, and we're talking about it from the standpoint, well, of course, of Glenn, and he's sharing with us a lot of wonderful insights, of course, into the book. We encourage you to pick up a copy. You can go to the website that I'm going to send you to today is going to be dragonsheir.com. And we're going to be linked to the website as well, because we want you to go there and check it out. Have fun with it is really the bottom line. And I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. And we want you to stay right where you are.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
Welcome back. Welcome back. It's glad to have you back. Good to have you back. I'm Richard Dugan, along with Glenn Paris. We're talking about, of course, his work that we're talking about. I want to say latest work, but, you know, it's funny because you say that this book was actually somewhat written back even before 2008. So it's your latest release, but it's been in the work for a long time. And now I don't feel quite so bad about taking 17 years, almost 18 years, to finish my short little tome of self-help regarding choices.
You know, Richard, it's interesting. You do something that I find very, very difficult, writing short fiction. I've always wanted to write short stories. And it was a long time before I finally found the way to do it. And the one short story I've got, and, you know, if I can plug that, if you don't mind.
Sure, no, go ahead.
It's called Unbitten, A Vampire Dream. And it's available now for Halloween, both in Audible and print through Litfire, and you can actually get the ebook online at Amazon. But again, you know, that's it's a short story. Again, there's this idea of the other creatures that, you know, like the gods of old, respect and fear man for his ability to evolve and his intelligence. You know, always underestimating us is how we always overcome.
Yeah, well, I question the whole aspect of intelligence because I sometimes wonder, you know, I really sometimes wonder who is the smartest creature on the planet. And there are many, many times that I'm going, it ain't
it's
man.
Not us.
Not today. Not today.
It's not us.
No. And of course, you know, the aspect of being able to write fiction, I wanted to jump into that as well. But I also want to talk about this aspect of our evolution, of the process that we are going through as human beings, and trying to understand our place in the universe. It's a real tricky thing because we keep getting different answers as time goes on. I mean, at one point, the church was telling us that we're the center of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then of course, well, no, we got a sun that we're orbiting. So the sun is the center of the universe and we're orbiting it. And then, of course, we find out later. And of course, there are those
kind of on the fringe.
Yeah. And then there are those who will say the earth is flat. And I never even thought of this before, but a good friend of mine and I were debating, talking about this. He's not a flat earth or anything like that. But he says, the one thing that I share with people who claim that the earth is flat is, okay, so when there's a lunar eclipse, why isn't there just a line across the moon of the shadow of the earth if the earth is flat? That doesn't make any sense, okay? In addition to if the fact that we've been out and orbiting the earth, we've been out to the moon and we've seen that little blue marble, as they call it, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, I have to tell you a sidebar here that there was a money shot when we were on the moon, and we had lots of opportunities for the money shot, and I've never seen it. And the money shot was a shot of the moon with an astronaut and or the rover or the limb and the earth in the background.
Right.
I don't know that there's a shot like that anywhere.
Yeah, and it would have been perfect.
Oh, God, what a stamp, what a postcard, what a poster
right.
That would have made. Oh, anyway.
Oh, man.
Back to...
I'd buy it.
I would, too. I'd buy a bunch of them because I was so fascinated. I mean, we were all glued to the set in 69. You know, in July and watching this whole thing unfold. Oh, and another sidebar, and of course, this is also in lieu of the fact that this movie, this wonderful movie, First Man, has come out and talking about Neil Armstrong. I remember hearing the story about his quote that is quoted, you know, infinitum, and it's incorrectly quoted. According to Neil, before his passing, he said he didn't say one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. He said one small step for a man, referring to himself.
Well, you know, I've heard this argument. That's what he meant to say. He prepared that announcement when he stepped on the moon.
Mm-hmm.
But he left out the word a.
Oh, did he?
Yes, and they have listened to that recording over and over again. They have processed it. They've tried to clean it up. He didn't say A.
What he
screwed
meant.
It up.
What he meant was okay.
That's
all
what
right.
He meant.
So
right.
I now stand corrected. You know, because I always thought it was the other way around. You know, without the
right.
A, and
that's
then
what
I
he
heard
meant to say,
yeah,
one small step for a man, one giant leap for mankind.
Right.
He left out the word A.
Oh well, not bad.
It's accidental. I mean, you know, it was a momentous occasion.
Yeah.
You can't fault the guy for leaving out one single letter.
No, you
know?
Can't. And when you think about it, too, this is one of the reasons that I'd heard why, for example, the controversy over the movie and how they left out the whole aspect of the American flag was that this was not a story about the Americans going to the moon. This was a story about Neil Armstrong, the first man on the moon.
Right.
You know, and it wasn't that we were trying to take anything away. I'm sure that we saw the emblems on their spacesuits of the American flag all over the place in the movie, as well as on the side of the rocket, you know, and so forth. But anyway, by the way, let me ask you, you're a man of science, and you also, I'm certain, do lean in the direction that, you know, we've been here multiple times and annihilated ourselves and we start over. By the way, I wonder where the seeds came from to start over the second and the third and the fourth and the fifth time.
Okay, so in the world that I created of the Ifalu in Dragon's Air, when the Ifalu, the dinosaur people, left Earth, they left in a fleet of spaceships like Noah's Ark. Okay. So they carried with them all the intelligent people of the time, and they also took enough animals, which included us because we were little more than squirrels at the time. they took enough of us to populate and balance out the new environment that they established elsewhere. But they didn't have to take all of us. So they left the rest of us behind to fend for ourselves. And the same way there's always the Save the Whales contingent, there were the keepers. And these were sarcastically called the keepers of the faith, because they felt that Mother Earth needed to be saved, and the animals that were her children needed to be saved. And they stayed behind to try to maintain and restore. In the book, the asteroid that hit was not accidental. It was actually an industrial accident. And then they tried to minimize the damage through technology. And that you're going to see in the prequel to the book that I'm working on. But they left us here after they fouled up the world. The job of the keepers was to maintain the world, and they would toy with us. They would toy with mammals. And when I say toys, and it's mentioned several times in the book, toys are genetically altered or augmented mammals. And that's how they began to look more and more like the Ifalu. That's why we look like we do. And the intermediate between us and those mammals of yesteryear are the creatures that we know from mythology, the giants, the elves, the ogres, the fairies, the centaurs, all the mythical creatures that are gone now. And some of those were considered demons, some of those considered gods. Maybe those were the creatures that shaped our civilizations and educated us and drove us to what we are, showed us examples of technology that we would have taken much longer to develop, perhaps. And we don't have the fingerprints of the keepers on us. And that is how we are surviving. Because if they can't prove that we are genetically engineered, then we are natural and we have a right to join the greater group.
Well, you better watch out. Science will catch up with you eventually.
Oh, yeah.
Now, that's another interesting aspect. I used to, I would say this humorously to people about science in particular, that at some certain points along the way, science comes to this particular conclusion that, okay, and now we have all of the 10 rules that govern the universe, and now we know. And then the following year, here's number 11. Now we have 11 rules. We know all. And it seems like there are, 100,000 rules, that govern the way the universe functions, and we keep discovering one, claiming that, okay, we've got it all now. And it's like the height of arrogance sometimes from my perspective. It's like, you need to calm down and just say, hey, we found another one, and we found another one, and now we found it. We're just another chapter to the book. The book does not have a the end on it. It just keeps going.
It doesn't. And again, as you say that, it segues into the glossary that I have for this book. And this is something that...
I was looking at that on your website.
Yeah, I think that was something that I probably was influenced by Frank Herbert on in his wonderful glossary of Dune. So I have the abridged Jingpen translator, and that's a glossary of who they were, what they were, some of their technologies and principles that guided them. But by implication, somewhere there's an unabridged Jingpen translator, and that's going to constantly expand as this world expands. As I continue to write, I'll be adding more concepts and terms and people to that list.
Is that is it easier to learn these terms than say, Klingon?
Oh, it's much easier. Well, first of all, almost all the terms are pronounceable.
Well, to me,
you can actually say them.
Yeah. I was going to say, because I know that one of the other aspects, and I thank you for providing that glossary. One of the things that I've always found fascinating about languages, and quite honestly, I only speak one fluently. At least I claim to speak it fluently, and that's English. I envy that we had a foreign exchange student on one of the programs here at the radio station, and she came from Italy. And in Italian grade school and high school, she learned to speak 5 languages, including Italian. Now yep. She's here as an exchange student, and she's learned 2 more, which is just amazing to me. But the thing that I find so fascinating in the little study that I've done about the Hebrew language, for example, each of the letters of the alphabet, the 22 characters, has its own legend. Just like on a map, you have a legend that tells you what all of the different symbols and the codes and everything on the map mean. And that each letter has its own vibration, its color designation, its numerical designation, its vibrational tone, musical tone, if you will, and on and on. And you start putting those characters together into words, it creates a whole new legend. And then you put the words to sentences, new tone, new legend. Sentences to the paragraphs, etc., on infinitum into books and so forth. The moment you translate that into any other language, that legend is gone.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that so fascinating because what happens, and I've had my wonderful conversations with rabbis on this program. God, I love talking with them because their education is just unbelievable. We were talking about one particular law from Leviticus, and he says, do you know why? This is part of why he says, you know, the you lose stuff in translation. He says, do you know why this particular law was put into place? Most people don't know the context in which this law was placed in this list of 613 Jewish laws. And so he went on to explain the context. And I was so fascinated, and I, of course, that's always been my argument when discussing philosophy and religion with people, is what was the intent when this was written? You know, what was, for example, Mary Magdalene, for example. She was the first, she was not only the first human, she was the first person, she was the first person to see Jesus after his resurrection, was a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And she knew who he was on sight. But when his disciples walked up, hey, can you tell us where the nearest pub is? We're thirsty. They didn't recognize the guy.
They didn't know him, right.
And I'm sitting here thinking, of course, you know the controversies.
They spent more time with him than anyone.
Well, exactly. And the controversy, of course, surrounding women within not only the Catholic Church, but just in terms of holding hierarchical positions and getting those kinds of educations. Like, for example, the movie Yenta with the Barbara Streisand. It's like, okay, the people who put the Bible together and decided which passages and books and so forth should be in there, they screwed up. Because they should never have included that in there, because to me, that makes her the head of the church, not Peter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because she knew who he was. Matter of fact, she wanted to touch him to make sure that he was absolutely real. And his response, I paraphrase this humorously, paint's not dry yet. you know?
I like that interpretation of that.
Yeah, paint's not dry yet.
You're not ready yet.
You're not, And so I just find it fascinating when discussing some of these things. And many of the authors I've interviewed have shed so much insight into some of these things. We did a series of programs. Maybe you can go back to the website and listen.
I'd love to.
There's a series of programs. There's a series of programs back in 2014. You'll need to go to the radio show's page, click on 2014, called Mythosophia, Exploring the Depths of Myth and Wisdom. And that was the most fascinating 12 programs that we did for that year that I had done in a long time, because I didn't get a real education in the Greek and Roman gods and mythology and all of those stories. Now, yeah, I watched cartoons and I saw fractured fairy tales and I saw Aesop's fables, you know, and the moral of this story is. But... you know, we talked about mythology in science fiction, in sports. We even had a gentleman come in, a Muslim who came in to talk about the mythology of the story of the Garden of Eden from the Islamic perspective, from the Quranic perspective. And again, we're still talking mythology here.
Sure.
So I'm curious as to your not only grasp, but integration of this concept, mythology, in science fiction. Or is science fiction just that? Is it our modern day mythology?
I think you're right on that. Science fiction is a lot of our modern day mythology. We now have explanations for a lot of the magic of legends and myths that go way back, that were to either teach or scare children. We also have the issue of translation, and you hit on it beautifully. I mean, that was an education you just gave me there. But what you are describing is the translation from performed music, and I'm talking about complex performed music, orchestral music, a first-rate band music, to written music. All right, you can write music on a page without identifying what instruments are playing it. And a musician can read it and can follow the melody, but you don't appreciate it as music on the page.
Mm.
You know how to do it. You know, yeah. All the instructions on how long the note should be, how the pitch of the note, whether it's soft or hard, that can be written. But the sound of the music, the woodiness of the instrument, the brassiness of the horn, those qualities are unique to the performance.
Hmm. You know, that's a subject that I actually put to my parents. I actually interviewed them on this program, although the interview is not available for the public because my mother said that she did not want it broadcast. So I honor that. I made it available to my family and they passed the link on. But we talked about the importance of music because you brought this up in their lives. What about the integration of music, not just, playing certain tones to elicit certain, shall we say, mindfulness and spiritual attunement and raising the raising our consciousness and so forth, our enlightenment, if you will. What about the importance of music and having it incorporate into some of these stories as well? Because I think, if I'm remembering correctly, there was a section within the context of even Stranger in a Strange Land, as well as the Dune series, where music was rather important.
Yeah, I mean, I can be perfectly honest with you. When I write to music. And when I say I write to music, I write to virtually all music. I mean, when I plug in my iPhone and I'm listening to music and I'm typing away and I'm writing, I'm listening to classical, I'm listening to country, I'm listening to rock, I'm listening to folk, I'm listening to 50s music, 60s music, 70s music, 80s music, I'm listening to hip-hop, I'm listening to alternative, I listen to virtually everything. Anybody who looked at my playlist, they'd say, where is this guy's head? Because he's got everything. He's got Kanye West and he's got Tim McGraw. He's got the Big Bopper. He's got Chopin. I mean, I virtually have every kind of music on my iPad, and it gives me a different vibe when I'm writing. If I'm writing a gothic vampire story like Unbitten, it's a different tone than if I'm writing an urban mystery suspense thriller like The Renaissance of Aspirin, and different still from the otherworldly Dragon's Heir. And I can tell you, I wrote a lot of that to an artist by the name of David Sanchez, a brilliant keyboard player and guitarist His heyday was really mostly in the 70s, but he's still very much alive, doing great music, brilliant pianist, classically trained, just an amazing artist. But a lot of his music helped me when I wanted to, you know, build the nuances of the world and the flavors that I put into the different characters and their interactions with one another and their emotions. So it sort of helps the flow of when I write.
I know that I love having music on just to listen to some, you know, one of my favorite artists and so forth. And I became introduced to just a wide and diverse type of an eclectic. I certainly had my favorites when I was growing up in the 60s, 70s and early 80s mm-hmm. with people like Harry Chapin and John Denver and Dan Fogelberg, who then introduced me to mm-hmm. Tim Weisberg, a great flautist. Also then became introduced when I went to work for my very first radio station, Jean-Pierre Rampal, the flautist. Also Vangelis. I was also introduced, of course, and I was very familiar, obviously, with a lot of the pop artists like Simon and Garfunkel and Judy Collins and Glenn and on and on and on. But then in the 80s, and after I got married the first time, I became a member of, at that time, a classical CD club, classical music. And I didn't care what mm-hmm. I ordered. I just wanted to hear the different pieces. And, of course, the ones that I really fell in love with, of course, were like Brahms because of a lot of the soft stuff. Rachmaninoff mm-hmm. was pretty good, but his was, you know, a little more contemporary, if you will, and a little faster tempo and so forth. But it didn't make any difference. I was working the overnight shift, and I would put that CD on, and I'd fall asleep on the couch in the living room, you know. And it was a great experience from that standpoint. And I love classical music to this day. I worked for a country station for 6 months, and I loved it. It was right around the holidays, so that made it even nicer. Mm-hmm. And even when I was working for the Christian radio station, there were certain artists that you know, sometimes the words were incredible, and the voices, and just the melodies and all this kind of stuff.
Sure.
And so music is a part of all of our lives, whether we're conscious of it or not, because it's always around us. And sometimes it's around us, like when you pull up at an intersection and a guy pulls up next to you and he's got the bass turned all the way up and he's rattling your car. But there is an impact. There is an impact in that regard.
There is an impact.
This has been a fascinating conversation. I'm curious, before we let you go, I want to know if there is a particular message or what have you that you would like to leave with the listeners, whether or not they pick up a copy of Dragon's Air, or just in the context of our conversation today, that you would like to leave with the listeners in that regard.
You know, yeah, there is. You know, right now, this country, this world, you know, we're really polarized. You know, sometimes to really understand someone you disagree with, you got to get in their face. And, you know, I've watched it with my kids. You know, my kids in high school were, what I would call, you know, really rude, not politically correct. They'd mock each other, but it was all in fun. They would forget it in a moment, and they would do it back and forth to the point that they could actually communicate. And I think that's the way you learn languages. You know, there's an old joke: you learn the curse words first, then you start, you know, because they're the most fun, and then you start picking up more and more words, and you mimic sounds, you mimic facial expressions and gestures. But it's part of communication. It's not just words. Words alone do not communicate between people. It's words, it's intent, it's emotion, it's the visuals of watching someone's body language. But then there's another quality, and I do believe that this really exists. There's another quality that borders on ESP between us. And until you get intimate, and in Dragon's Air we talk about intimate communication, essentially a form of telepathy, that augments old-style language, verbal language. And there's a comment about, you know, this English that these people speak, it doesn't even follow a melody. It's not even, you know, it's not even harmonic. You know, what are these people doing? How do they live not being able to communicate more intimately?
Mm-hmm.
So I say all that to say, when you pull back, you'll never understand the opposition. When you understand the opposition, inevitably, the other guy's got some ideas right, and you really want to get to the same end.
Yeah.
And when you start to realize that, you start to come together, and that's the, let me get a little patriotic here. That's the strength, that has been the strength of this country. The fact that we bring so many different perspectives to the center for the benefit of all of us.
Yeah.
And I sound preachy with this, but I really mean it.
Well, I agree with you, especially in that context. James Redfield said it best in his Celestine Prophecy trilogy, mm-hmm. That we all have messages for one another. And that if we, and I kind of tack onto this, if we put up our shields, like in Star Trek, you can fire your weapons, but nobody can transport in. So now you can't get messages from them, and they can't get messages from you because their shields are up too. So we've got to drop the shields, and we've got to start exchanging those messages because, I put it this way, we're all working on a puzzle that's got an innumerable number of pieces. And every person that you come in contact with, you have an opportunity to glean from them another piece that's going to fit into your puzzle. And if you deny yourself that opportunity, you are also denying them that opportunity to get their piece of the puzzle from you that's they're working on their overall puzzle.
Only from a position of vulnerability can you really know another person.
Yeah.
And it's got to be mutual.
Glenn Paris.
That's true in life and love.
I want to thank you so much for joining us on the program, Glenn. This has been fascinating. And I'm going to say this. I wasn't going to say this before, but I'm going to say it now. In our two conversations, I can honestly call you brother. The joke would be, twin brothers from different mothers or something along those lines. We may or may not agree or disagree on particular subjects, but the reality is the conversation, I think, has elicited some new things. I've certainly learned something in regards to Neil Armstrong and have been put back on the straight and narrow, so to speak. And I thank you so much for giving us so much time. I look forward to having
you. Thank you so much for the conversation. This has been great.
Yeah, and I hope that if you find your way here in Santa Barbara, we'd love to have you in studio because we could continue. Or, you know what? I joke about this, but I'm in all seriousness. Either in studio or I'm going to take my little digital recorder, two microphones. We're going to take some beach chairs. We're going to go sit out by the ocean, and we're going to have a conversation that we'll record to put on this program.
I'll buy the margaritas.
I'm with you on that one. And before I let you go, I do have three final questions, but I want to let our listeners know of your website, which is dragonsair.com, and that's H-E-I-R. Dragonsair.com is the website. It's also the title of his latest release, Dragon's Air, and we hope you'll pick up a copy of it. And I just out of quick curiosity, this isn't one of the three questions. How many books do you have out now?
I have two novels and one short story that I actually decided to release as a just sort of a an interval thing for a collection that I'm writing.
Oh, that's very cool.
But just two books right now.
And the thing is that even though it's just two books, the intricacies of these books and the information that you sprinkle through it is just it's incredible. First question that I have for you is, who is Glenn Paris?
Now that's a hard question. Glenn Paris is a physician, and I like to educate. I like to heal. I don't like leaving mysteries. I don't like walking out of a room with a patient who still has questions about his or her health or remedy. I like to say that I seek truth by day, but I lie by night.
And vampires are just the opposite, right?
That's right.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
Mostly, I think this is just self-actualization. I like to communicate my life experience through writing. I like to put forth, and again, I take a page out of Gene Roddenberry's book. You know, I like to put forth our best hope. I'm not a big fan of apocalyptic and post-apocalyptic fiction. I have more faith. I have more optimism than that kind of literature lends to. And I just feel that man's best days are ahead of him, not behind him. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that everybody believes that, but I do.
Well, finally, what is your life's purpose?
My life's purpose is to leave behind human beings that are better than I was. And I'm hoping that I've done that with my children. So far, I think that they're definitely on the way to being that better human being. And hopefully I can influence people who come across my path to serve their better angels. And if I can do those things, then my life will have been worth something.
Glenn Paris, author of Dragon's Air, and the website dragonsair.com. And again, we thank you so much for your time here on the program. And again, we do look forward to having you back in the new year as it's fast approaching.
Yeah. Well, Richard, thank you so much for having me. Thank you for the invitation. I've loved the conversation. I'd love to come back and talk again.
We will definitely have you back. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love to Lal.